I'm wondering what you think about the radical homemaking movement. AK Press just recently put out a book about radical homemaking. I guess that it can take place in a lot of different spaces, but like it can be urban, it can be just a small, like, having an urban garden and living your life differently, or really on a larger scale of like people moving out to a farm and homeschooling their kids and engaging in barter. Sort of, I think that the movement itself understands itself to be sort of embracing reproductive work, but critics have suggested that it just sort of reproduces patriarchal relations because it sort of sends people back into the home.
I think that we have to draw a difference between activity, projects, initiative that may be useful and may be important from an individual point of view, from those who actually are, constructive in a broader sense, who
Right.
actually are transformative, who are creating new relations, new structures, not for small groups of individuals, but actually on a broad scale. And they're really, in a sense, challenging the system in the way it is constituted. And to me, this is the area, these are the spaces, the social spaces that I'm interested in. Because you can, of course, transform your home, but there are very, very important limits to that. And also, what we need is not only individual solution, but really there are solutions that have, a broad scope, and particularly also solutions that increase our capacity to resist the state, reappropriate, the wealth which is now in the hands of the state, and in a way really create a different type of social system. So whereas, as I understand it, radical homemaking may be a change on an individual scale, I think that we really have to move on another level.
Do you know how to do that? I mean, I think that these things like can be meaningful on an individual level, right? How do we take that from the individual level and make it grander than that?
Well, I think that you make it grander when you begin, to, for example, look at solution not only in terms of your home, but you look at solution from the point of view of the broad structure, whether it is reproduction, domestic work, or whether it is education or healthcare, right? That means that you're not only working within the confine of your home, but you're bringing in all kinds of different social actors, right? For example, if you're all working around the healthcare, which is an important part of reproduction, then you want to work also with people in the community, but also with nurses, with workforce which is in the healthcare system. And I think that's where the change begins to happen, when you bring together those different social forces. For instance, I think one of the movements that is now is having an important impact on the question of domestic work, as an example, is the movement which is now international of domestic workers, well, paid domestic worker. I think it's very, very interesting what is happening with them. In fact, I often speak of it as a new women's movement because they are taking on many of the issues that at least the mainstream of feminism left behind, in the 70s. The whole question of revaluation of domestic work and the fact that women need to come together, and not only women, but women, because to this day women are the primary subject of this work. Rethink the way this work is done, and also domestic workers, paid domestic workers. Today, many of them are immigrant women, women of color, so they are placing the issue of domestic work, also on a different basis, because they are bringing out the connection between the devaluation of housework and the devaluation also of people of color who have often been those who have done this reproductive work, you know. And so they're also bringing in the question of immigration, the issue of borders. They are looking at the question of reproduction, making connections with many other, you know, areas of struggle. So that's an example where you create new structures. In the United States, we are beginning already to see a change. Until recently, until 2010, paid domestic work in the US was not considered work, because the labor legislation that was introduced in the 1930s did not include paid domestic labor. The invisibility of reproductive work was such that even when this work was done, you know, on a commercial basis, it was not considered real work. It was considered a form of companionship. There has been a broad movement in recent years, and in New York State, the change came in November 2010, when the governor actually extended the labor legislation to include domestic workers. And just in recent weeks, I think it was 2 weeks ago, in California, the same happened. The Governor Brown, you know, signed in a bill that in fact extended the labor law. This is very interesting because the United States, you know, you imagine this work still not recognized as work. I think on the question of healthcare, education, I think that we need to bring together people in different community organizations with people who are working inside the institution, the schools, the hospitals, to really begin to reconstruct the process of healthcare or education, because these are now disaster areas where services are only cut, where privatization is rampant, where the closing of hospital and closing of school, they are going hand in hand, so in many communities are really nothing. And, you know, we need to really begin to form broader coalition of people who are beginning fighting to stop this privatization, but also to begin to reimagine something different. Because the schooling and the healthcare that we are being provided now is not what we want. We want something better. We want something that is not, you know, just a band-aid, you know, a way of parking our children away while, you know, their parents go out to work. And so this is the process where I think the transformation begins to occur. You know, we need to have perhaps the equivalent of what the Occupy movement began, you know, and in the neighborhoods, with maybe neighborhood assemblies that are bringing together all these different social forces. And then together put pressure on the state in many different ways, but also at the same time begin collectively to determine what is the we need, what is our need, and what is the kind of care, the kind of health, the kind of education that we want.
Do you think that it's possible to create that society within a civilization that right now is so large? I mean, I think that in Canada, at least, we have 3 different political parties. And I'm not suggesting that the political parties represent everyone. They certainly don't. But you have the Conservatives at one very far end and the NDP at the other very far end, supposedly. And, you know, I mean, how can we come together and create and dialogue about things when there's some foundational things that we're not in agreement about?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I wouldn't want to speak about Canada, but I would say looking more internationally at the situation, certainly in the US, there is a real process of vast alienation of people from parties. They may go out to vote, although even the voting, it's never really, the majority of people do not vote any longer. You know, there is in fact a kind of a disconnect between the bulk of the population and the institutional structure, which is becoming deeper by the day, because anybody will tell you that they don't feel the politician pay any attention to them. And I think that people are beginning to realize, in particular at a certain, below a certain income level, you are on your own. You're really on your own. We saw that in New York very dramatically at the time of the Hurricane Sandy, when it was clear that all the resources of the administration, of the government, went to take care of people in Manhattan, of the middle-class neighborhood, upper-class neighborhood, whereas people who were in the coastal areas, the poorest communities, they were the most affected by the hurricane, you know, were completely left on their own, and only because of a number of grassroots organizations, including people from Occupy, they were not completely left on their own. People went there and they brought the bank, etc. So this is now what is happening, I think, on a large scale. I think what is necessary is to, you know, begin a process that breaks that isolation, the sense of despair, the sense of paralysis, that loss of hope, mm-hmm. that is so debilitating that even the whatever we could begin to do seems now impossible because people give up. They've been disappointed so many times. The alternative is more despair because there is no real alternative. I'm starting from there. It's not that there is another path.
So you think that it's possible for people to...
So I think it has to be tried.
It has to be tried, right?
It has to be tried.
Sure. I think that... you know, there's
we have to assume it is possible.
Sure, I mean, that's a good place to start from,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel sometimes that, I mean, and I find myself getting into this headspace
yeah.
too, right? That you know, the climate crisis,
yeah.
for example, sometimes, you know, it builds and it builds to such a point
yeah.
that you feel like, okay, I just have to shut it all down.
Yeah.
You know, there's
yeah.
there's nothing I can do. And,
yeah.
And you do, you lose that hope, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, without that...
Yeah. Without that, you don't even do what can make a difference, you know, and I think these first steps are always the most difficult, but, you know, again, I look at different places in the world and I see that usually it's the people who have least who are more ready to take a step because they have really no alternative. They realize they have no alternative. There are some very glaring examples that over the years I've been very inspired by. For example, in Latin America, from Chile to Argentina to Peru, you know, over the 80s, you know, late 70s, 80s, when you had the coming together of stiff austerity measures, the imposition of very, very stiff, you know, massive pauperization, this is what we're talking about, massive impoverishment,
mm-hmm.
and massive unemployment. For example, in Chile, after the coup, the Pinochet coup, you know, Argentina, and then also political repression, you had basically women coming out, coming together and beginning to form all kinds of community groups, community organizations, to basically in the name of survival, in the name of the survival of their families. But over the years, these forms of survival, you know, the Urban Gardens Committee, Glass of Milk Committee, Sewing Committee to make some clothes that would be then sold the manichada or circulated the manichada, the comedores populares, the popular kitchens, and where women, 20, 30 women in a barrio, in a neighborhood, who cook, shop together, cook together. Then over the years, this coming together also had a profoundly transformative impact, you know, because it really gave women much more self-confidence, began to circulate all kinds of information and knowledge, you know, not only about the materiality of reproduction, but also about what would be going on in the city with the repression, with the government, who's been arrested, etc. And also transformed their relationship to housework, to reproduction, to men, to their family, because they began to spend more time out of the home with other women, beginning to sense, gain more self-confidence,
mm-hmm.
and to discuss so many issues pertaining to the fact of being women, pertaining to their relation with their husband, for example, domestic violence, you know, for example, healthcare, sexuality, arguments that in the past would have remained taboo. They would never have, you know, had the courage to address. But in this new environment, you know, in this new kind of, you know, day-to-day familiarity with each other, you know, became possible to discuss. And so even activities that began as out of necessity, not out of polity or any particular vision, but because, and the women engaged in as wife and mother, you know, from the point of view of very traditional roles. But nevertheless, the very fact of having taken the step, you know, began to also create a whole process, or unleash a whole process of transformation. You know, transformation of themselves in their relationship to these activities, and also transformation in the very process of reproduction.
Do you think that it's possible to have this transformation, or to begin this transformation, without the crisis, like setting
well,
it off?
Well, it's very interesting, you see, then this is what we, I think we have to grapple, and I say we, I imagine, you know, I extend, I guess, to Nova Scotia, or Canada, you know, what I know from the United States.
Sure.
Because, you know, the United States too has so many different realities. And, yeah. You know, I come from New York, and so I speak from a very particular, very urban, you know.
Sure.
And not only urban, but the experience of a town that has been, you know, a target of a massive assault by real estate speculator, financial speculator. They have completely torn apart so many neighborhoods, so that the network of solidarity that existed in those neighborhoods, you know, have been are gone. And this is the particular crisis that we are facing.
Right.
It's not only the economic crisis that has to do with the cuts and with the restructuring of the political economy, but it's also the crisis that comes because that restructuring has really disintegrated, you know, areas and organizations that existed. They were a tremendous support for people. Whereas the example that I'm making from Chile, from Peru, you know, I think the reason why those activities were possibly, you know, were so extensive and was in part because it was women who engaged in. Mm. And women were beyond suspicious. Women and women moving as mothers, you know, identifying themselves as mothers and wives. So they didn't represent a threat to the system. In their mm-hmm. patriarchal bias, they didn't see these women who come together, for example, at first
right.
to cook together. They didn't see them as a threat. Later on, the government in Chile, for instance, saw them so much as a threat that they would send the army into the neighborhood to destroy the pots. And in fact, they began to accuse, to begin to label cooking together as communism and send the army in the neighborhood to destroy and to arrest women who would be cooking together. So this is very interesting because they realized, you know, how in the same way as now many governments across the world are attacking street vending, you know, after with the global restructuring of the economy and austerity program, etc., many women to make out a living have gone out in the street and begun to sell things in the street. Sometimes they make do little, you know, artifacts, and then they go to the street. And so the street has become a place of gathering, of coming together. It's become a little common. Because when you're sitting together in the street, you know, we may look at it and say, oh my God, poor women, they're sitting in the street. But actually, there's a great power there. You talk to each other, you exchange a lot of information. You see, in the street, much is happening. You see all kinds of social forces in the street. You become quite knowledgeable. Of you see the police, you see, mm-hmm. you know, the people are coming, the vendors. So now, these governments are now attacking these women, and you wonder, why are they attacking these poor women who are selling some apples, selling some clothing, selling? But because they realize that there is a whole social fabric that is being constructed there, you know. Now, we start from a position in a place, say, like New York, where we have seen massive gentrification, lots of people kicked out of the city, massive economic restructuring, you know, so jobs and so on, industry going out of the city. And so those networks are not there any longer. You know, that is the crisis that we are meeting. It's a crisis of lack of resources, but it's a crisis also of lack of those connections, of that social fabric that is so important for resistance and for imagining something different. So that's where we need to, you know, start rethinking, reconnecting. And added to that, the whole question of reproductive work, you know, which has been chopped up in the many little houses, many little, and in create organized in a way that is very isolating, mm-hmm. you know, for those who are performing, women mm-hmm. or men, mostly women, but women and men. And so we need to think it in a different way, you know. There is a beautiful book. Then maybe some of people who are, maybe that many will know it already, and if they don't, they might get some inspiration by this feminist urban sociologist, urban planner called Dolores Hayden, The Grand Domestic Revolution. And it's a very interesting book because it's a book, Dolores Hayden has written many, many good books. It's also the redesigning of the American dream, I think, the American home. What the Grand Domestic Revolution does is looking at the long period between the 1860s after the American Civil War, right, to the 1830s, you know, which was a period of mostly middle class, white middle class, but feminists rethinking of the home. Right, with all the limits of the fact that most of the women who were engaged in it were white middle class women. It's interesting that this debate that begins to happen about restructuring the home takes place after the Civil War, the end of slavery.
Right.
Right? Yeah. And you can be more cynical and say, yes, of course, now that the servants right. are not available any longer, the women are. Yeah. Or in a more different mode, you can say, well, women were also making the connection yeah. between slavery in the fields, in the plantation, mm-hmm. and also slavery in the home, you right. know, which is a more different type of slavery, but nevertheless, confinement and so on. I think that both approaches have something. But so what Hayden looks at is this vast, is a broad area of social experiment and social vision, many, many drawing from the anarchist tradition, utopian radicalism, Fourier, Owen, the working class, the, you know, utopian working class thinker of the second part of the 19th century. Others are basically from an incipient feminist tradition, women who call themselves materialist feminists, who were wanting a, again, different kind of life, and they began to feel the suffocation of the traditional home and beginning to think of different spaces, you know, how about houses where people eat together? How about places where there's not a big separation between the neighborhood and the home? And so she points out that that experimentation was extremely productive. But by the 1930s, you know, the state moved heavily against it, you know, basically saw it as antisocial. I mean, actually, they began to, you know, assault ideologically and otherwise, you know, even groups that today we'll see as completely congenial to the status quo, right? Who simply wanted some sort of reform
right.
of domestic space. That kind of desire, mm-hmm. energy at the service of restructuring, rethinking the home, yeah? And rethinking reproduction in more cooperative ways, so that this tragedy that we are living today of hundreds of thousands of women going crazy every day because they have to make some money and then they have to care for children, and then they have, when people get sick, and this sense of despair, this sense of being alone, this sense that nobody cares, and this sense that, you know, one more day and I'm going to die, which many in the younger generation will see when you're young. Unless it's right in your home, you don't see it. But it's there, it's all around us. This is where we have to address.
I feel like having two small children, I have a lot of friends and acquaintances who also have small children. It seems that it's a particularly tough period of life.
Yeah.
But I don't know what comes after that. But I feel like a lot of those people that I know and who are from very different situations in different places seem to be just kind of saying in passing, oh, I wish that we could live in some kind of communal space, you know, so that we could share childcare and share making meals. And it's a sentiment, I feel, that is spoken a lot. I mean, I'm not sure that anybody knows how to even take the first step into making such a thing real.
There's a big first step because, you know, all the forces are against that, but that's our defeat. If that passes, and I have no guarantee that by taking these first steps, the victory is at hand. But I'm saying if this kind of breakdown, isolation, this centrifugal forces, when we are going to have a very miserable life and we are going to live a very miserable future for our children, that is, I think, the challenge. Because, for instance, at the level of space, now the apartments are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I've seen the same apartment in New York, you know, being chopped every 10 years. The rent doubles and the space, it happens.
Right.
And to the point now that people are being expelled from their own apartment. You cannot live in your apartment. You can only sleep in it and have a quick shower. You can invite friends, they're too small. You cannot have a meeting. So you see now the cafes full, but the cafes you have to pay.
Right.
So you have to pay for the food, you have to cook outside. So you have to cook, you have to stay in a place where you have to buy 3 cappuccinos to do your work. You know, so when you think of reconnecting in the commons, you have to deal with space. You have to deal with time, you have to deal with people. The other hand, unless something like this begins to happen, you know, and again, I would say it must be bringing different social forces together. I think that we need people from inside the institute, we need the teachers of children, we need the people in the nurses, we need people in the nursing homes, from the elderly. We need to really begin to dialogue and bring those people together. That, in my view, is the way to go. And to create spaces in the community where those people can come together. And people come together despite the difficulties of life, you know. People still find time to go to a football game or to watch this. People still find time to do. I think we need to have the courage to think that we can actually make some difference.
I mean, and that's a hard thing to find, I think, right? That courage and that faith. You know, that such a thing is possible.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is a beautiful poem by Bertolt Brecht. It's about the Buddha, and it's about he imagines the Buddha to be walking along the road. He sees all of a sudden on his left a house on fire. The roof is on fire. Inside the house, people are dancing and having a good time. He rushes and he says, "The house on fire, the house on fire, get out, the house on fire." And people turn to him and say, "Well, how is the weather outside?" And he shakes his head and continues along his road. So it's true, but we cannot ask, "How is the weather?" Because there are really no alternative. In a way, they're, for many people, the death is already now. That desperation is already there. The fact that their life are dying on a day-to-day basis. They see their own life slipping away on a day-to-day basis, lost amid tremendous amount of work and anxiety and sense of loneliness and despair. I think that that is where the energy must come from, must be to refuse to let go, to refuse to see our life as only make do from day to day at best.
It kind of sounds like you do need to get to that crisis in order to see that transformation, but you have to be in that crisis with a sense of hope, right, as well.
And then, you know, I think there has to be also some idea of what we want to achieve, some concrete steps. For example, I always make the point that in the 70s in New York, you know, there was a convergence of movements, social movements, strong enough that they were able to set up in the communities daycare centers, which they run, which were communally run, not by parents, but they were communally run, but all the resources were provided by the state. Now, there was a limit, because the moment in which those movements lost their power, they began to fall apart. Then the state withdrew, they didn't have the power to keep the resources. And so, in a way, we have also to find means of becoming more autonomous, right? Creating for... But nevertheless, it's a very important lesson that when people are together, also the relationship with the state, because the state has a lot of resources in their hands, and we need to find ways. So I think that, for example, to say, okay, if we come together, then we can go to the state. And we can say, okay, we want a house, we want a center in our neighborhood. We want a center because we want a place where we can, our children can go and play. Something very concrete that can immediately make a difference, where you don't need to have a nuclear war in order to achieve it.
Right.
But at the same time, begin to be a place. For example, Occupy has shown that having a space, you know, was a very important, you know, that being together, body to body, not just through the internet. And so having a place, for example, in the community. So setting some modest, concrete goals, but at the same time, that they can begin to aggregate people, they can begin to give the sense of transformation, the sense of hope. That, to me, it's a way of building the commons. And from there, also then, dealing with the issue of work, with the issue, you know, what is happening in the hospitals, what is happening in our homes, what kind of things we would like to be able to have in the community, so that if you are at home and somebody is sick and you don't have to make an appointment with a doctor, they will see you 3 weeks later and we want to see if you have an insurance or have to go to an emergency room, but that you can have some structures that are available at the community level, where there's all kinds of information. That this is the kind of thinking. For example, in Italy in the 70s, after the, because of the women's movement, the struggle around abortion, and the whole insistence of women, of my body, myself, right? You know, wanting to understand better about sexuality, procreation, learning about how our body works. Then they were able to win the institution at the community level of these spaces called consultori. These consultori were spaces where there would be some nurses paid by the state, and but they would be available there in the community. The women could consult about issues of abortion, about issues of health. You know, there would be like something in between the hospital, which was much more directly responsive, much more directly responsive to the need of the community. Those had a very, very important role. Many of the nurses and then doctors would be there at times. So it was a place where you could, much more accessible. These are these possibilities. The feminist movement, when in the US, when it seemed that the government would deny abortion, or abortion would be declared illegal, they began to create structures, underground structures, to say, okay, we'll do abortions. right? Then eventually abortion was legalized, although now it's under assault in so many ways, in so many ways, right? So all those are examples of ways in which at different points organization and communities began to be activated, this process of self-activation, right? See some other structure. Yeah, this is what, rather than home caring. Home caring is not about structures that everybody, you know, can access.
You talk a lot about the movements in the 60s and 70s, and I mean, obviously they were extremely important, and I don't know what it was at that time that made such a thing possible. Is there something that exists right now that makes such a thing possible again? Well, is there hope?
Yeah, I see. Well, I don't know what has been happening, for example, here after the dismantling of the Occupy movement. I know in several places in the States there's still something taking place at the level of knowledge commons, you know, for example, creating spaces outside the market and the state and the universities to where people come together to discuss issue of common interest. So that is taking place. The question of Hurricane Sandy. So the people that have been involved in the Occupy movement are still somehow mobilized. Yeah, they have not gone home and everything is forgotten. So people now are thinking about, okay, the issue of housing. How to, well, organize not only to stop eviction, but to find ways in which work with the homeless. We have an organization called Picture the Homeless to basically challenge the whole issue of homelessness, deal with the question of homelessness. So there's been some encounter between Occupy. This is the house issue, it's one. Two, the question of education. There's been less, to my knowledge, about the question of healthcare, you know, but yeah, I would say that there are several initiatives, small, but we have what we call solidarity economies, the notion of time banking, we have the gardens. So these are small initiatives. I guess the question for us is how to put them in contact with each other. Right. How to build something bigger. But there is a broad interest about the bartering scheme. There are different bartering schemes. The other day I was in a social center where they were discussing this bartering scheme. I was not enthusiastic about it. From Argentina, where people on the internet find ways of exchanging services and goods, you know, on the basis of points and so on, with the idea of escaping the market, of exchanging resources outside of the market. I thought the way it was done, maybe I didn't understand it, it seemed very complicated. But the desire is there, you know? The desire is there.
I'm not sure that there has been anything particularly lasting emerging from Occupy here. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't really see it. I think that for us, I'm not sure that it's the same in the States, but in Canada, I think that some hope is seen in the Indigenous movements. I think, you know, they have been quite successful and have raised a lot of awareness, and I think people find hope in that.
Yes.
And, I mean, obviously, certainly there are, you know, there are sort of moments of barter and, and that, but it seems like that there's still a lot further to go. But I do think that Occupy has been very successful in raising awareness, right? And just the possibility of people coming together and raising awareness of the, you know, I mean, maybe breaking through a bit of that loneliness, right? Like, and putting the language, you know, into the sort of public sphere. I mean, and I think that's a good thing, right? That's
absolutely
hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a common there in a way, right? And I think that for many young people it was a very transformative experience that they began to realize what being together, you know, and not only being together in the sense of talking, but also beginning to realize that what happens when you can begin to cooperate, you know, when you have a cleaning team, or putting together a library, or contacting the farmers so that you can, you know, draw some good food, distributing food, etc. And of course, to me, the notion of the commons is very much, very, very, you know, in effect, as a matter of life and death for that project, you know, based on the ability to overcome, you know, racial and sex, you know, division and boundaries of gender and race, which are some of the major division in this society. And so, you know, commons, it's also a way of organizing beyond exclusion, you know, on the basis of breaking down those division. And it's very, very also complicated because the experience in the US, you know, was, this was one of the main challenges, particularly when it came to the issue of homelessness, the fact that many homeless people, you know, came to those spaces, came to the commons.
Mm-hmm.
Some people carrying a lot of problems.
That was an issue here as well.
You know, mm-hmm. mental disease and, you know, aggressiveness. For mm-hmm. having been a long time in the street, you accumulate a lot of aggressiveness in some cases. And, you know, the movement often was not prepared. You know, there was a whole educational experience, but also one in which people were not prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that maybe because I'm now, I don't know, I think we have to refuse to see things as hopeless. So I see that that was a serious problem, but one that we should learn from rather than despair throw up.
Mm-hmm.
Many Occupy situations were torn apart by the inability to deal with. In some cases, people kept calling the police.
Right.
Because they had homeless people. In other cases, they split up because right. some said, oh, these guys are coming in just for the food
mm.
and that they are not political at all and we are here for the politics. And that created a real division. So that issue, for example, I think that issue, those moments of quote, failure should be moment of great learning, should be moment of great debate, should be moment they should not let go and say, okay, that was not possible. Should be, like with the women's movement, what is that it made possible for the great energy, transformative energies that I was referring to in its first phase, you know, to then be captured, you know, then to be over a part of years, this is a great masses of women out in the street, combat, the movement then shrinks.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, those are moments that should not be the cause for despair or for giving up, but for learning and growing
right.
and saying, okay, what is that we need to do the next time? What is that that is being the obstacle? That I think would be extremely important. Because we don't know, this situation, this movement keep happening and we cannot really create them. It's very unpredictable when a movement will. Now, looking back at Occupy, we can say, oh yes, there was this, but it's really unpredictable. But we can be prepared by saying, okay, these were the problem. How do we work on this problem? That is possible, right? How do we work? For example, let's say there was an Occupy today. How do we deal with that? There's a beautiful pamphlet that a number of comrades, young people, who in fact some working with the collective called Team Color, I don't know if you know that collective, mm-hmm. they've actually put out books, they've been put out a lot of material over the years. These are people who have been together. Now they work in different places. But one, Craig Hughes, put out a very, very interesting pamphlet in relation to New York, where he was a critical commentary on some of these issues in Occupy, and he was especially powerful, his analysis, because he has been for years and years working with shelters, working with precisely with homeless people, with people who have had also mental problems. And therefore I had a very extensive knowledge of what are the services that the state provides or does not provide and how they are being provided. And it was especially critical of those parts of the Occupy movement whose position was, well, we shouldn't be doing this work. Actually, they have all these services, so our work, if anything, is to connect these people with the state.
Right.
And he will say, no, the state, if anything, is not providing services to deal with them. You know, those services are administered in such a way that actually the people who should benefit from them refuse them. It's not... So there are people, you know, who are working. That's why, to me, the question of these spaces, when we mean of a social space, we mean in particular to create a new circulation of subjects, of people in different, you know, those who work with the shelters, they know, those who work with homeless people, those who work in the to making those connections. Because in that way, for example, people like the one who wrote that pamphlet have a much better understanding of what the problems are, you know, what some possible solution, what a movement like Occupy could have done or could do to address those questions. Because we all have limited experiences, right? We all have see a particular corner of the social, you know, social factory. And we need to bring in.
It seems like there's the connections to that, obviously, with the like, you know, feelings of alienation that we have,
yeah,
right? And you're like, I feel right now, just when you were speaking, I was like, I feel totally overwhelmed with, like, how would you possibly bring all those people together, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, the
yeah.
point, of course, is that it's not my responsibility.
It's not yours. They are the people who know how to do it, who yeah. work with them. And the question is how you connect with those people.
Right.
Yeah. During the weekend, on Saturday, I was in Philadelphia at the gathering called Rebel Nursing. I was able to stay only one day. And I expected something more. I expect more questioning of the general framework of healthcare. But in any case, these were nurses who felt the need to come together. You know, even if they were all thinking of how improving nursing and care within the framework rather than challenging the framework, mm-hmm. even though they knew that the framework is a mess. That's what everybody said. It's a mess. But they still were thinking of working within that framework rather than really see how we can go also beyond it. Nevertheless, it was indicative that they felt the need to come together
mm-hmm.
and particularly speak to a new generation of those who are graduating now from the nursing school and say, okay, this is what you need to know. This is what you know about, you know, people who are now so disgruntled with the healthcare. And not only disgruntled, they don't even trust it. They might not even want to go close to it because they are so afraid of what they might do to them because of the history of racism and so on. They go and then they feel totally put down. You are a sex worker, right? So they were dealing with those issues, the issues of being of people who are dealing with the healthcare system and they are constantly put down. And then they self-exclude them. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And then they roll into crisis. So that is interesting. That to me is revealing that the point of crisis are so many. You have the doctor, the nurses,
yep.
and the aides. And the aides are the ones who are in a state of, you know, war. They are continuously cutting the monies and increasing the hours, increasing the number of patients they have
yep.
to serve. And they are blamed for all the faults of the system.
That's right. I mean, and there's a hierarchy with the doctors and the
Absolutely.
Different kinds of nurses.
Right. Yes.
And so, that pressure and that anger just gets passed down the next level, which gets passed down to the next level. And and it just makes for an ugly system.
Very, very ugly. Very. And then you have at the end, you have this patient. And many of them, for example, people have Alzheimer's, people are... And the AIDS, less and less, they even have the time to say a few words, to have any human communication. Yeah. So they are forced into treating people like machine. And then they are hated by the families and by the patients because they feel like, oh, it's your fault.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you treating me like a machine, you know? And this is a system that thrives on basically getting away with everything. They cut the resources and then they make people fight with each other.
Yes,
and in fact, some of the AIDS, there was a powerful article I read by a nurse, an aide. She eventually decided to leave. She couldn't take it anymore. And she described how the hospital, after they cut the time they can spend with the patient, you know, saying, oh, you were washing 5 and until yesterday, but start tomorrow, you wash 9. The hospital tells the family, or you know, those nurses, they come from Nicaragua or El Salvador, they don't know about hygiene, you know, that's what they tell them when they come in and they see that they are still not combed, because they haven't had the time, literally, but then they tell them, you know, they use all the racist stereotype. So this is what we are dealing with. I think if we put in our heads the fact that we are going to be in those hospitals, our parents are going to be in those hospitals, we better do something, even from their limited point of view, which hopefully we go beyond their limited point of view. But even if people could begin to understand that, you know, one way may be to unhinge some of these very resistances to moving, is to begin to explain, you know, that now if you go to a hospital, even if you have some insurance, it's much likelier that you may get the wrong pill. Because when you have these nurses who are overworked, who cannot send their money to their, you know, like so much anxiety and overwork, you're not going to get good care.
No.
You know, and your mom is going to come home with bed sores because they don't have the time to turn them around in bed. And if they have an operation at a certain age, they might come home with a hole in their back, which is happening in so many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Patient upon patient comes home with bed sores.
Mm-hmm.
These are tragedies. These are tragedies that can consume months and months of a life of a family. I don't speak in abstract.
Yeah.
You know, as one example, you know. So people have to understand that these are very real problems. We're not talking about abstractions or, you know, that this is what is happening. And, you know, we will continue and get worse in this neoliberal climate where they're continuously pushing and pushing to take away what was conceded at times when there was a higher level of struggle. You know, they keep pushing. And unless we create some resistance, you know, we will be the ones in those beds.
That's right.
Or our family will be the one in those beds. Our children will be the one, you know, who will be there with an IV for 20 hours before somebody comes.
Mm-hmm.
Like we've had discussion about hospitals where entire wards every night don't have one nurse. So they have one nurse who, you know... takes a walk, because what else can they do?
Yeah.
This is the reality. So, yeah, who's going to stop it? Who's going to change it? Certainly not, you know, our you know, hospital who are looking at the dollar sign or the politician and so on, unless people intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an interest there in the families, in the communities, and also in the workers, in the nurses, the people are working in this institution.
It's true.
You know, for example, community should have a say. They should have the capacity to say, no, this is going on in this hospital. We don't want this. That means you have to come together. That means you have to have an assembly. That means you have to maybe gather in a church, gather in a school, gather someplace. Mm-hmm. This is not astronomical. Right?
Yeah.
There are tragedies happening every day in hospitals. I know poor, low-income, every day. There are things that are happening. And also not only so poor. You know? So maybe, you know, seeing how many times people are so overburdened, they do not know or pay attention to what is happening next door. People who went to occupy Sandy, you know, they went to these very, very poor communities. They discovered that poor, often they have been there years without talking to each other. That it was when they started saying, okay, we have to do something together, because there were people trapped in the apartment, people without medicine, people without heat. In many cases, neighbors would not talk to each other, you know, even though they were clearly in the same boat.
Right. I think we've been...
Yeah.
We've been taught, right? Not to speak to each other.
Yeah, and to be afraid, and my God, what am I getting involved in? You mm-hmm. know, there, you know, all this film, all that, there is immense investment. I mean, just looking at TV, like 1 week of TV, the cops, the people with all these maniacs, all this, there's been a tremendous investment in making us feel that there is a world mm-hmm. where everybody, every other person is a threat to
right.
us. Whereas the real threat, which is the fact you're going to a hospital, you're going to die because you're not going to have enough care, or you don't have any kind of, you know, real help when you get sick,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, your work accident, the workplace, you know, there's more people die in the industrial workplaces, or of chemical spills, or of poor infrastructure. In the United States, we have seen bridges collapsing because of lack of infrastructure maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen communities, neighborhood blow up because of the tubes, the gas, the pipes had not been changed in a long time, and gas was coming out. Several cases of building destroyed because the pipes were leaking, you know, or at the border between Maine and Maine and Canada and Quebec, the terrible, terrible accident mm-hmm. they wiped out half of a town
yeah.
in Quebec, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there was this train full of chemicals. You know, there is now such a lack of care that it's a threat. You know, that now we, much more than in the past, I think this corporate hegemony, it's legislating that we are dispensable.
Mm-hmm.
That their ability to proceed unimpeded, you know, it's has to be absolute.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, seeing the presence of BP today in the school, you know, BP has given $500 million to Berkeley University, and they're now running programs in Berkeley University in the United States, you know, as well as running very, very cheerful, we love you ads, mm-hmm. you know, making us forget that they have destroyed the livelihood of thousands and thousands, and they have created an immense ecological disaster in the Gulf, clearly beyond.
I was reading a couple of the articles from mm-hmm. the Revolution of Point Zero, some of the more mm-hmm. recent articles, and you were talking about about these kinds of things, right? About these corporations that have this kind of power and are doing who are plundering obviously mm-hmm. resources and people,
mm-hmm.
and in the moment of reading that, I know I don't want to linger in despair. But
yes.
in that moment of reading that, I feel so overwhelmed with the thought that, you know, it's people, right? It's people who own these corporations, who are making these kinds of decisions and seem indifferent, uncaring.
Well, I think of slavery.
I guess.
Look, yes. Think of slavery. Think of the people drop nuclear bombs and also devise nuclear bombs and think of, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I think there's been a tremendous amount. You know, some people have chosen not to care, to be completely alienated from the rest of the human species.
Yeah.
And, yeah, unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, this system reproduced them. And that's why I think it's very, yeah, it's very important to create moments of aggregation. Because I think that, you know, confronted with that horror, so many people withdraw and assume mm-hmm. that nothing is possible. I think that losing the sense that we can do something is the worst thing that can happen.
Yeah.
Once you've lost that, once you've lost your voice, then you shrink, then your life becomes, you know, day-to-day machine-like and lots of anxiety and pain. This life may be terrible, but on some level we have to transform it.
And I mean, you know, coming full circle back to where we began, you know, I think that some people, I think it's a small portion of people, but some people choose to run to mm-hmm. the woods, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, and
maybe that's as good. It's good for them. Great.
Yeah. But it doesn't change anything, right?
That, you know, maybe change their life, and that's the best they can do. Look, to me, if you don't hurt other people, that's fine. But on the other hand, it doesn't really transform your life. And maybe you go out to the woods, but then maybe there's fracking next door.
Right.
Today, the woods are not always a solution. You may think you go to the woods and it's a happy life, and then you discover the next door, they are doing fracking,
mm-hmm.
right? Or there is maybe a nuclear dump. If I feel our lands are so booby-trapped that even the little individual paradise that people think they can construct soon reveal their very serious shortcoming. The woods of America today, God knows where they got it. God knows where they got.
I had read recently, people, there was a lot of talk about Fukushima, and
yes.
And there was a petition going around saying that basically it's out of control and we're
completely.
Not really talking about it anymore.
Completely.
But it is out of control. And then, you know, and they wanted to get world experts to come together to try to contain the situation. And then just after that, somebody else, I read somewhere else, somebody saying it's not as bad as
Oh, it's
that.
Terrible. Oh, no, it's horrendous. It's out of control. It's completely out of control. In fact, now it's so bad. There was a documentary the other night that was absolutely terrifying. You know, because it showed that at the Fukushima site now, they have, I don't know, many hundreds and hundreds of immense containers of highly radioactive water. And that's only one small part of the whole radioactive water that they have collected since. So then they moved up to miles and miles away, and they show like this huge field. You would think it's a green meadow. Actually, they have put this green cover on it. It's all containers full of radioactive water, and it's miles. And the journalist was saying, oh my God, to know that all this will be there generation and generation and generation in a thousands of years, this stuff will still be radioactive. And the government now is adding, continuously adding, because they don't have a solution. They can only pour more water. And in reality, what they are doing, a lot of it, they are storing, a lot of it, they are throwing into the ocean.
Right.
Which means we are likely eating radioactive fish.
Right.
Nobody's monitoring here, but I know in the United States, they already found radioactivity from Fukushima, which they can trace from Fukushima, on the coast, of the Pacific coast. You know, at different points from Oregon down to California.
Wow.
But there's such a conspiracy because TEPCO is an American company.
Right.
So, you know, it might explode again.
This is very scary thought.
Very scary. And in this case, talking about the commons, it's mostly women, and talking about the production while organizing around it. We had a group in New York. Now it's come to an end for all kinds of reasons that I'm not going to go into. Not because the cause was not worth it. But it was called We Are All Japan. And there's a website called Jay Fisher's that has a lot of articles, very, very good articles and analysis. And one of them is about the struggle in Japan against this. And it's about mothers who are the first who came to the foreground to organize, to get Geiger counters, to basically refuse the government propaganda, which was saying, all is fine, and moreover, if it's not fine, you should show solidarity with other Japanese people by eating contaminated tomatoes. They sell love tomatoes in the Tokyo supermarkets. They call them love tomatoes. And they are tomatoes that come from the area of Fukushima, and presumably you show solidarity. Yeah, they are calling people, show that everything business as usual, because otherwise we cannot export our rice, because otherwise our economy would suffer. But women are saying, no, I don't want my child to eat this stuff. I don't want my child to live in an area that is... And so they are the ones who've been organizing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There are an awful lot of things that we are asked to do for our economy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Okay.
Thank you so
no,
much.
No, nothing.
This is a really a very interesting discussion.
Thanks.